Free the Jews. Let's free the Jews. Let's begin this cultural conversation because it seems like an opportune cultural moment to do so. Not only because of the things that are going on with certain celebrities right now, but also because the triggering of the Jewish diaspora seems to be at a fever pitch. There's just a bunch of things happening right now that are causing sort of an outpouring of terror. And I don't think that's fair. And this is something I've wanted to talk about for many years, but it just never seemed like the right time. And it does today. So what I want to do is point out what I've observed. And it comes up in a lot of branches of my research. And that is that it really seems like Jewish leadership and others, other predatory sorts of people, have kind of built, hold on to your hats, a cult. They've done the classic formulation of a cult so that when they want to and when they need power, they can trigger the people inside of it into certain reactions that will help them. All right. And the framework that I'm going to go over this with today is something like this. This is the bare bones. I'm going to talk about the Jews as the chosen people, although that's sort of the given. That's the cult, the chosen people cult. And I'm going to show how this has created kind of an us versus them mentality, which again is essential to building a cult. I'm going to use a lot of references and descriptions that go to Robert Lifton's book, The Psychology of Totalism, and his 8 criteria for thought reform. And we're going to talk about this in terms of the state of Israel and Zionism. And then I'm going to show, hopefully, that the cult has now moved on from anything to do with its religion into the globalist religion of social justice. And that is done through Tikkun Olam, which is identified as being a social justice movement led by progressive Jews. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up, and one of the cultural moments that happened for me, is I just watched the movie Hannah Arendt. The movie is set in the 1960s, the early 1960s, when Hannah Arendt goes over to cover the trial of Adolf Eichmann that was happening in Israel. And so she's living in the United States. She travels to Israel to cover this trial. She meets up with her friend, Kurt Blumenfeld. And he's the character in the movie says this: "Our young people refuse to confront what you call the dark times," which was the Holocaust. "Either they're ashamed of their parents who didn't fight or protect themselves, or they accuse them of having behaved dishonorably. They think only criminals or whores could have survived in the camps." So it was really interesting to me to realize that in the early 1960s, by the early 1960s in Israel, the youth didn't care. They were moving on. Mentally, they were moving on. They weren't paranoid about the Holocaust. That was history. They weren't worried about anti-Semitism. That was history. And the prime minister of Israel at the time, Ben Gurion, he saw this as a problem. That is something that Hannah Arendt wrote about in her book and in her coverage for the New Yorker magazine of the Eichmann trial. She spends quite a lot of time describing how David Ben-Gurion, Prime Minister of Israel, had sort of a show trial in mind from the start. It was meant to rehash and emphasize and set the narrative about how the Jews were the main victims in Nazi Germany. And one of the things Ben-Gurion said about this trial of Adolf Eichmann, who they had kidnapped from Argentina and brought to Israel to try, which many people thought was illegal in the first place or extra legal in the first place because Israel, the state, did not have a place in trying this man. But anyway, the trial went ahead. And one of the things Ben-Gurion said was, it is not an individual that is in the dock at this historic trial, and not the Nazi regime alone, but anti-Semitism throughout history. Right there, you can see the character of this trial. And Hannah Arendt says that Ben-Gurion stage managed it from the sidelines through the prosecutor, the main prosecutor. In this passage here, Arendt describes that her sort of opposition to this trial in the first place, because it's not about justice in that case, it's about something else. She says, justice demands that the accused be prosecuted, defended, and judged, and that all other questions, though they may seem to be of greater import, and one of those questions is, how could the Jews, through their own leaders, cooperate in their destruction? Why did they go to their death like lambs to the slaughter? All of those questions should be left in abeyance, because that's not what justice is about. Further, she writes, this case was built on what Jews had suffered, not on what Eichmann had done. The prosecutor at the Eichmann trial had said that at the Nuremberg trials, they had left out the tragedy of the Jewish account, and that was his business there to bring that to the forefront. He said it was the business of Jews to sit in judgment on their enemies. She assessed that what Ben-Gurion was after was to remind those who were too young to know the story, or, as in the case of Oriental Jews, had never been told it. The trial was supposed to show them what it meant to live among non-Jews, to convince them that only in Israel could a Jew be safe and live an honorable life. Hannah Arendt says that Ben-Gurion wanted a lesson for the non-Jewish world and said, I want to establish before the nations of the world how millions of people, because they happened to be Jews, and 1 million babies, because they happened to be Jewish babies, were murdered by the Nazis. And it goes on. He wants the world to know and to be ashamed. The Jews in the diaspora were to remember how 4,000-year-old Judaism, with its spiritual creations, its ethical strivings, its messianic aspirations, had always faced a hostile world. He said, it is necessary that our youth remember what happened to the Jewish people. We want them to know the most tragic facts in our history. And she wrote much more, of course, but I've selected parts where it shows how Ben-Gurion and the prosecutors in this trial wanted it to go. That it wasn't about justice, that it was formulating this narrative, almost re-traumatizing the people who had gone through it, and hoping to traumatize and anger the Israeli Jews that were young, who hadn't been there, the Jews out in the diaspora who had not been there, who had not maybe ever heard this story or had faded from their memories. That was his purpose, and his purpose also was to shame the rest of the world. Well, it worked, didn't it? Because in my opinion, and I'm 51, my entire life I have been exposed to the story of the Holocaust from the Jewish point of view only. And I'm talking every single year in school growing up when I was a young kid, they showed us those movies when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, every year, of the emaciated people, and of bodies being piled into pits. This was traumatizing. And this narrative was repeated and repeated and repeated, and it is dominant. And if I were Jewish, I can't imagine how that would make me feel. But we're going to get into that now, how it would make people feel. Hannah Arendt said that the trial had this result. Not only has their conviction of the eternal and ubiquitous nature of anti-Semitism both been the most potent ideological factor in the Zionist movement since the Dreyfus Affair, it must also have been the cause of the otherwise inexplicable readiness of the German Jewish community to negotiate with the Nazi authorities during the early stages of the regime. This conviction produced a fatal inability to distinguish between friend and foe. That's amazing. Because honestly, that's what I see out there right now. There are people who say things that are not at all trying to hurt the Jewish community, but people are on a hair trigger. And if they even sense that it might be interpretable in that way, they go crazy and they want to eradicate it from existence. They are not able to distinguish friend from foe. They put us, everybody, but especially Jewish youth, through this cycle of trauma by reintroducing this all to them, by expanding and dramatizing the story every time they tell it. That's the trauma, which leads to a psychological dissociation in many people, even momentarily. But when people dissociate, they are highly vulnerable to suggestion. And that's when you can plant these post-hypnotic suggestions, these trigger things. Now, you might notice that this is a method that a lot of groups use these days. It is not by any means limited to the Jewish people. This is how it kind of works now. And everybody kind of ends up in one cult or another through the trauma conditioning that I've just described. And I just briefly want to show you a little bit of the science behind this. Is the dissociative adult suggestible? A test of the trauma and fantasy models of dissociation. And in this paper, they show that consistent with prior research and with the trauma model, dissociation correlated positively with trauma severity. But the important point there is that a trauma will cause a dissociative state. They have proved this. And I want you to keep in mind that a trauma does not have to be experienced directly. In the case of bullying, for example, it has been shown that observers watching the bullying often experience more psychological trauma than the person who's bullied themselves because they are helpless, the observers are helpless to prevent it. And I mean, you don't have to be, by the way, ding, ding, hello, you don't have to be helpless to prevent the bullying, you can step in. But in some cases, of course, you can. And so even that, even observing it or hearing the story of a terrible tragedy counts as trauma. And then just the second one here, hypnotic suggestibility in dissociative and related disorders. They did a meta-analysis of other research here, and the highlights are patients characterized by severe dissociative psychopathology display elevated hypnotic suggestibility. Elevated hypnotic suggestibility was most pronounced in dissociative disorders. And when they did their study, it revealed that patients displayed a greater hypnotic suggestibility than the controls. So people who had some dissociative characteristics were more hypnotically suggestible. So I hope I'm showing that when you expose people to trauma, it could potentially be used, exploited by those who would seek to control the people that are being exposed to the trauma. They can put ideas in your head in those moments when they know you're in that emotionally dissociative state. And then later, they can do a callback by showing you images or speaking certain words. And it can, not saying it always does, but it can trigger that same emotional response in the person. And then that person is guidable, suggestible. Okay, now I'm going to turn to Robert Lifton's 8 criteria for thought reform, and I want to go over each of these and show examples of how I see them being used to keep this sort of Jewish diaspora control from some central authority that either wants you to donate money or donate your time or go to a protest or get a professor canceled or call for censorship. All of these things, okay, they can move groups of people around by calling back to that trauma and then using these mechanisms that I'm about to go over. So there's milieu control, mystical manipulation, otherwise known as planned spontaneity, the demand for purity, confession, sacred science, loading the language, doctrine over person, dispensing of existence. Those are the 8 criteria. Now let's go through and I want to show you how I see this all fitting in. The First one, milieu control. This involves the control of information and communication both within the environment and ultimately within the individual, resulting in a significant degree of isolation from society at large. All the messages bombard you, like I've just talked about. Eventually, you don't need the message. It is actually something you identify with inside. It is part of who you are. And then where it says a significant degree of isolation from society at large, this doesn't have to mean physical isolation like we just had with COVID. And I hope you'll notice how a lot of this stuff, COVID is another cult they're building and have built. The isolation is the us versus them. It's that you start to think of yourself as special, different, chosen, an outsider. And often that is just automatic hostility. Like, they don't understand me. They're trying to get me. It happens, and I'll show that quite poignantly in a minute. And the isolation at the beginning, straight after World War II, really was created in the state of Israel. They wanted more and more and more Jews to come. They wanted that before World War II, but nobody really went. Nobody really went to Israel. Isn't that surprising? Until after the World War II, until after the Holocaust. So there's that type of milieu control. And the people in Israel, the Zionists, they have that now. That's all covered. And it kind of left like, oh, well, now what do we do? Well, in order to enact all of the trauma, all of the milieu control on the rest of the world and the diaspora, and particularly, I would say, in the United States, but I'm not familiar with how it goes in other parts of the world, there is the consolidation of media. This article is from 2020, and it says these six corporations control 90% of the media outlets in America, the illusion of choice and objectivity. Now, a lot of these companies are headed up by Jewish people. This has been pointed out many times. Okay, but the point I want to make here, I mean, that's a significant point on its own, don't get me wrong. The point I want to make is they're not even right. The person who did this research in 2020 missed something. They missed the mergers that had happened in 2019. In this article, we learn that CBS and Viacom merged in August 2019. So that's scratch those, they're one now. And it also says in that article from LA Magazine that there was a consolidation of AT&T and Warner and also Disney and Fox. So it's way more than 90% of the media messages, and this includes entertainment as well as news, are controlled by just five or fewer now, maybe, corporations. And much of the control of those organizations is Jewish in the first place. So the milieu control is very tight. And then you add on censorship, where they will not allow people to put competing ideas out there. No other narrative but our narrative is what they say. And that's very, very cult-like. That is very, very much in keeping with the psychology of totalism and thought reform, which is another word for brainwashing, by the way. They keep changing the names of brainwashing. I don't really know why, but I suspect it's so that people can't do good, solid research throughout history. You have to know what it was called at various phases of time. So we have brainwashing, we have thought reform, and now we have like coercive control and other words for it as well. It's all the same thing. Moving on to the next area of thought reform. Number two, mystical manipulation. There is manipulation of experiences that appear spontaneous, but in fact were planned and orchestrated by the group or its leaders in order to demonstrate divine authority or spiritual advancement or some special gift or talent that will then allow the leader to reinterpret events, scripture, and experiences as he or she wishes. Well, if you think of all other cults, it's very obvious that that happens, isn't it? But to show it in action in Judaism, I want to call your attention to this documentary, which was made in, I think it was 2009, called Defamation. It's a really, really interesting documentary, and it follows people around that do the censorship and do the lobbying of government. It goes to actual news stories to show how they're reinterpreted to make it seem like it was an anti-Semitic event when really it wasn't. But the part I want to show you is when the filmmaker goes over to Israel and he's accompanying the teens on a trip to Poland. And they do this every year with a group of teens. And he says at the beginning that when he was a kid, like 500 people a year from the whole country used to go. And by the time he made this documentary, it was more than 30,000 a year that do this. So I'm going to show you some little outtakes of that section with the teens all strung together. I think it's going to be about 4 minutes long, sorry. But it's important that you see what I mean by the trauma, then the dissociative state, then they're suggestible, and then you come in and you tell them the things you want them to know. You've formed the minds of the children. All right, watch this.
כל אחד יגיד מה החיבור האישי שלו למסע. למה הוא רוצה לנסוע לפולין?
אני דור שלישי לניצולי שואה. ומהרגע הראשון שסבתא שלי סיפרה לי על סיפורים על השואה, ראיתי את המבט שלה, מבט שלא נסלח ולא נשכח. וראיתי מה היא מרגישה, אבל לא הרגשתי את זה גם. זה בעיקר מה שאני רוצה להרגיש במסע, את התחושה של לא לסלוח ולא לשכוח.
The kids are going through a longer preparation for the trip to Poland. The school counselor is in charge of their mental preparation.
ותנסו באמת להבין את הקשר בין אז להיום. זאת אומרת, האנטישמיות זה דבר שלא נגמר. אומנם בעקבות השואה קמה מדינת ישראל, אבל האנטישמיות זה משהו שיש עד היום, וכל הזמן תקראו עיתונים. מלבד זה יוצא איתכם גם מאבטחים, יוצאים איתכם מאבטחים. המאבטחים לא יאפשרו לכם ליצור שום קשר עם האוכלוסייה המקומית. תפגשו שם אנשים שלא אוהבים אותנו. תראו, לא אוהבים אותנו, תחשבו שאתם, סלי. גם היום, אני אומרת לכם שוב, גם היום לא אוהבים אותנו שם.
The man with the blanked out eyes is an Israeli secret service agent.
קורה איזה מצב ששומעים איזשהו פיצוץ, לא משנה כרגע מה. מה שאני מבקש, דבר ראשון, כולם לשבת או לשכב אפילו במעברים כמה שיותר מהר, בסדר?
Traveling around Poland today, it's hard to imagine what it must have looked like over 60 years ago. But the guides helped the kids to visualize and feel how it was under the Nazi regime.
יסמין, את תהיי מבחינתנו המודל של אמא של דנקה, את תיכנסי מתחת למדרגות שם ליד העצים ואנחנו נצלם אותך.
מה היו עושים הגרמנים?
היו זורקים אותם מהחלון פה, אתה רואה? כן? היו זורקים אותם?
בגטו לובלין. גטו יהודי בעיר לובלין.
ישראל? לא תמוך פה ישראל, אני אתם גדש פה יד פוגליסקו. ימי שם שסכין נסתשת. תו
גדו, ישראלציאני?
פתאם שסכון. עד פתירו יק פגיעם ישראלה, לא תפגיעו שתר.
אינגליש. הוא מדבר רעות על ישראל, הוא אמר שאנחנו כלבים.
הבנתי.
בואי כבר, מה את מדברת עם אחד כזה?
שומר עלינו מהאנטישמיות, כאילו שומר שלא יבואו מתנגשים או כאילו יעשו לנו משהו בלי ש...
את חושבת שזה יכול לקרות?
כן, זה יכול. הרגע, היום בבוקר היינו שלושה אנשים מבוגרים יחסים, שרק שמו שאנחנו מישראל ודפקו לי פרצופים ואמרו שאנחנו קופים וחמורים ועוד שנייה, כאילו, היה מכות שם.
הם לא אמרו שום דבר כזה.
לא?
לא?
הם כן.
לא?
מה אתם לא יוצאים?
יש.
לא, לא קשור לאיפות, מה? הייתי יוצאת. יש נאונאצים, כאילו פה בפולין, שיש סכנה, יש לנו סכנה, כי נגיד הם יכולים לדפוק לנו בדלת, בלי שנדע מי זה, ויכולים להתחיל לזרוק דברים מהחלון.
זה מה שנגיד הסביר לנו בארוחת ערב, הביאו לנו תדרוך, שתכלס אנחנו לא במדינה אוהבת, אנחנו במדינה יחסית עוינת. נגיד אם יגלו איפה אנחנו עשינו לו פה הפגנות בחוץ, או אבנים זרקו עלינו, ונגיד לפני שבועיים יחסו לי פה שיקורים כאילו נאו-נאצים, התחילו לדפוק פה בתלתות ויחסו יהודים. ככה כאילו הסביר לנו אתמול בארוחת ערב.
מי הסביר?
השבק, תשמע, אתה דפוק, אנחנו אוכלים בסבבה, פתאום הבא יש לי כמה דברים בשיא העדינות. אתה רואה כזה אחת כזה, אשכנזי חמוד כזה, פתאום הכי לראה איתך על נאו-נאצים וזה, כולם היו בשוק, לא יכולים לסיים את האוכל.
זה היה כאילו האיכות שלנו, שאתה יודע שאף אחד לא סבל אותך, אבל אתה גאה בזה.
כאילו מגדלים אותנו מגיל קטן על זה שאנחנו נדע שיש לנו שונאים. לא יודעת, על כל מיני דברים כאלה. ובעצם כשהילד יודע שיש לו שונאים, וש... כאילו מה שקרה בשואה לדורות הקודמים שלו, אז זה גורם לך איזה סוג של כעס לצד השני, לכאב, כעס, אפילו שנאה.
זה יחזק בי את הישראלית שבי, את הציונית שבי ואת היהודיה שבי.
You hear it from the teen's own mouths, at the end there. We're special because no one can stand us, but we like it that way. When a kid knows from the start that he is hated, it evokes anger towards the other side, pain, anger, even hate. This will strengthen the Zionist in me. And I haven't gotten there yet, but there's an organization that now brings children from the Israeli diaspora over to Israel for summers, and they live with families that have gone through this process. So the trauma programming is spreading. Number 3 on the A criteria for thought reform, demand for purity. The world is viewed as black and white, and the members are constantly exhorted to conform to the ideology of the group and strive for perfection. The induction of guilt and or shame is a powerful control device used here. Now, there's just so many examples of each one of these, but the one I want to show you is Birthright Israel Foundation. And in this article from, it's funny, it's just the other day, November 29th, 2022, it's about how the billionaires, Sheldon Adelson and I don't know which Bronfman is in charge of this now, billionaires are saying they're going to cut the number of students because they're not getting enough donations anymore. They're going to cut the number of people who go over to Israel to be traumatized because they want more money from the regular people to do it. And they say Jews should bear responsibility for this gift by donating to the cause, okay? The gift of traumatizing the children. They sell it through, of course, guilt and shame here. You're falling down, Jews. You're not donating enough. But they also say, look, this is what we get when we pay for this. The participants in Birthright Israel were 58% more likely than their Jewish peers to feel a lot in common with Israelis, 54% more likely to feel a great deal of belonging to the Jewish people, and 160% more likely to have a Jewish spouse. The findings demonstrate that Birthright Israel is a strategic asset of historical proportions, they say. Well, if that isn't some kind of demand for purity, I don't know what is. And check this one out. In the Times of Israel, Michael Leitman wrote in January 2022, "The peoples of the world cannot escape anti-Semitism. It is in their genes and in their blood. It is a law of nature. Jews can ask nothing of them until the Jews themselves bring correction to the world. They hate Israel until Israel corrects them." What? That is unbelievable to me, actually. Talk about putting an us versus them mentality in there. He says hate for Jews is in the blood of non-Jews. I find that disgusting. And the next criteria is the cult of confession, closely related to the demand for purity, is an obsession with personal confession. Confession is carried beyond its ordinary religious, legal, and therapeutic expressions to the point of becoming a cult in itself. There is the demand that one confesses to crimes one has not committed, to sinfulness that is artificially induced, in the name of a cure that is arbitrarily imposed. So that has a lot of virtue signaling in it. The social justice movement demands this sort of thing. Confess to crimes you haven't committed, sinfulness artificially induced. I'm on unceded territory. Call this man a woman. This sort of thing. And it's a bit of a reversal on confession. What you're supposed to do is constantly proclaim that you're not sinning. So it's a slight twist, but I think it amounts to the same thing. And secondly, the Jewish people now seem to see anti-Semitism in everything. And then what they do is they perform elaborate fear rituals, almost in competition. Who can get most hysterical about this perceived anti-Semitic slight? I'll show an example in a minute of people just seeing anti-Semitism in everything. And the next criteria is sacred science. The group's doctrine or ideology is considered to be the ultimate truth beyond all questioning or dispute. Truth is not to be found outside the group. The leader, as the spokesperson for God and for all humanity, is likewise above criticism. This offers a considerable security to young people because it greatly amplifies the world and answers a contemporary need to combine a sacred set of dogmatic principles with a claim to science, embodying the truth about human behavior and human psychology. And wow, can we ever see that at play with this switch over from religion to science? And an example I'd like to give you is from that same Times of Israel article that I showed earlier by Michael Leitman. He uses statistics here to sort of prove that anti-Semitism is on the rise. This puts an aura of unquestionability onto this notion of, you know, categorizing anti-Semitism. There's so many assumptions that have to go into these numbers in the first place, but people see mathematics, they see statistics, and they think, oh, well, that is a definite provable science. And they can't be questioned. A second example I want to show you is the Tikkun Olam, repairing the world movement. And Zionism fits into this as well. That is a sacred social science. Both of these things really are. Zionism is the centuries-long effort now realized in the nation of Israel to find a homeland for the Jewish people. It is a political movement more so than a social one, but it did engage in cult-like manipulations and concoctions, such as the creation of a modern Hebrew language, in part to distinguish the adherents and loyalists from other groups. It's a bit of sacred science right there. The modern Hebrew language was not invented until the 19th century, the late 19th century, I believe. Tikkun Olam once meant living the laws of God and spreading the word of God. Now it means an imperative to repair the world according to social justice principles. On either side, though, Zionism or Tikkun Olam, the main thrust for the Jewish people is that they must dedicate their lives to the cause, and the cause comes before everything else. Social science, now, they call it. So it seems like a natural, provable law of nature, but it isn't. I just want to point out that the Bronfman Fellowship, so the Bronfmans again from Birthright Israel, they have a whole charitable foundation that focuses on Tikkun Olam. And in this video here, the young woman describing what Tikkun Olam is and how it ties in to social justice, she says 56% of Jews now feel that social justice is integral to their identity, and that is more than three times as many Jews that say that ritual practice of their religion is essential to Jewish identity. So, guys, my Jewish brothers and sisters out there, if you would allow me to be so bold as to include you in my group of humanity, they're playing you. At first, it was all about your religion, but over the last decades, they have morphed that It is not about your religion anymore. It's about social justice, which has nothing to do with you as a Jewish people. They even warped the meaning of Tikkun Olam, which I hear is in the Torah. But in the Torah, the missionaries are supposed to go out and spread the word of God and living the principles of God. It's not supposed to mean healing the world and getting involved in everything this woman lists here. Like, get a load of this. I'm going to play 30 seconds or less.
So in the past few weeks, we've done a very quick tour through a few movements in which Jews have been deeply involved, movements that Jews have both shaped and been shaped by. We've talked about the labor movement, the civil rights movement, and the women's movement. And of course, there are so many other movements that we could have covered. There's Zionism, peace and anti-war activism, LGBT activism, Soviet Jewry, environmentalism, genocide in Darfur, immigration reform, Occupy Wall Street. There's so many places where we see Jews' involvement and where we could connect it to issues of Jewish tradition and history and identity.
It's not supposed to be about healing the world and getting involved in every type of social justice and committing your life and your money to those causes which in the end only serve the ends of the controlling group, the ones who traumatize and re-traumatize you over and over and use you cynically. What's next? What's next? Loading the language. The group interprets or uses words and phrases in new ways so that often the outside world does not understand. This jargon consists of thought-terminating clichés, like anti-Semitism, which serve to alter members' thoughts processes to conform to the group's way of thinking. Yeah, anti-Semitism, automatically they freak out, right? And then they're highly suggestible. But there's more. I mean, like I said earlier, they totally created a new language. Yes, it was a revived language. There was Hebrew in the past, but it was gone. And they formulated this in the 19th century, Hebrew was revived. But there's something else too. Shibboleth. I want to introduce you to this term. Sam Bankman-Fried really introduced everybody to this term the other day. A shibboleth is a custom or tradition, usually a choice of phrasing or even a single word that distinguishes one group of people from another. Shibboleths have been used throughout history in many societies as passwords, simple ways of self-identification, signaling loyalty and affinity, maintaining traditional segregation, or protecting from real or perceived threats. Now, Sam Bankman-Fried used that word in a really interesting way when he was texting back and forth with a friend who worked at Vox News. The friend ended up acting in her capacity as a reporter rather than a friend, and she released the texts. Now, this is very interesting. She says, "You were really good at talking about ethics for someone who kind of saw it all as a game with winners and losers." And Sam replies, "Yeah, hee hee. I had to be. It's what reputations are made of to some extent. I feel bad for those who get effed by it, by this dumb game we woke Westerners play where we say all the right shibboleths and so everyone likes us." Well, by shibboleths in this case, what Sam Bankman-Fried means is Tikkun Olam, which is also all of the sustainable development goals. These tie together. Social justice and the sustainable development goals are practically one in the same, only you see more of their economic applications in the sustainable development goals. So yeah, Sam Bankman-Fried, if you recall, sold his whole fund on he was going to save the world. He was going to save the world, and that's how the big media types introduced him. Look, he's a billionaire who's into effective altruism, and he's going to save the world. Meanwhile, he was just ripping people off all over the place. And the thing about that is, well, maybe I get into that later. Pardon me. We'll move on. We'll move on to the other loading the language example, anti-Semitism. The ADL tweets all day, every day, about anti-Semitism, and it's a powerful, powerful lobby. But according to them and the other people in charge of the milieu control and the information flow, you can't say globalist. Typo. You can't say globalist. That's an anti-Semitic trope. You can't say international bankers. That's an anti-Semitic trope. They say David Icke meant Jews when he said aliens in his presentation. Calling something a ritual child sacrifice is apparently anti-Semitic because they think it's the same as the blood libel. It doesn't matter that nobody mentions Jews when they say these things. It's still anti-Semitic. In some ways, it cracks me up because it's like they're putting a big neon sign over their head, pointing to what they feel guilty about. Globalism and international banking. And I hate to say it, but ritual child sacrifice? I mean, why do they get so defensive about this stuff and say it's anti-Semitic? Why? I mean, it's not a smart strategy, you guys. I'd like to wake you up to that. All right, what's next? I'm going to do these two together. Number 7 and number 8, doctrine over person and dispensing of existence. Doctrine over person is a member's personal experiences are subordinated to the sacred science, and any contrary experiences must be denied or reinterpreted to fit the ideology of the group. And then dispensing of existence is that the group has the prerogative to decide who has the right to exist and who does not. This is usually not literal, but means that those in the outside world are not saved. They're unenlightened, unconscious, and they must be converted to the group's ideology. If they do not join the group or are critical of the group, then they must be rejected by the members. You can really, really see this in Scientology, and Leah Remini has done a good series about that and how they, what do they call it? Fair gaming. If you contradict the group or, God forbid, leave the group, they go after you, they smear you, they stalk you, they try to ruin your life. And we've had many, many reports of this happening with COVID as well. But in the context of Judaism, I'm going to point to a couple of people. Jews, well-respected Jews, until they took the opposite or point of view of the powerful Jews. One of them is Norman Finkelstein. He was canceled like way back in the early 2000s because he wrote a book called The Holocaust Industry. I mean, I can just see the triggering heads exploding with just that phrase alone, never mind what the book claimed. The Holocaust Industry: Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering. And he also wrote a lot about the Palestinians and how Israel treated Palestine. And they viciously attacked him. Of course, they got him canceled. He's probably one of the earliest to be canceled in the latest round of cancelings. So there's him, and there's Hannah Arendt, who had been she's a genius. In my opinion, she's a genius. And she had been a darling of intellectuals, especially Jewish intellectuals, because she's Jewish herself and lived through the Holocaust forever. But then she covered the Eichmann trial, like I talked about in the beginning. And she is still unwelcome among them, although apparently some progressive Jews are finding some use in the things she wrote and are trying to reintegrate her work into their society. But they just wrote her off because she said what she said when in that New Yorker piece that I read you excerpts of in the beginning. You can't do that, according to them. You can't be nuanced. You must adhere to the narrative or you're out, dispensed with. But the last example I want to show you actually is, it goes only with doctrine over person here. Doctrine over person, where if it can be reversed, like you get accolades as long as you put doctrine over people. And the example I'm going to give you is Sam Bankman-Fried, because although he stole all the customer funds, practically, roped them in with this idea he was going to save the world, he was a mathematical genius, everybody could get rich on crypto, and they held him up as a little boy wonder. Hundreds of millions, billions of dollars went into this fund. And he lost it all. And he laughed about ripping people off. I showed you the shibboleth thing. Well, just the other day, he was in New York at something called the New York Times sponsors every year called Deal Book. And they invite a bunch of people to it. And after he finished talking and admitting that he ripped people off, the audience there gave him a standing ovation. So when you think of doctrine over person, there's also this notion that as long as you are advancing the goals of the leaders of the collective, or of the group, of the cult. And that's the doctrine. As long as you're advancing the doctrine, you can do no wrong, no matter if you hurt anybody. Doctrine over person. And I want to point out, in this tweet about it, Chef Andrew Gruhl ends his admonition with saying, America, as if it's America's fault, as if it's unique to America that they would give a standing ovation to a criminal like this, quasi-criminal like this. He's a criminal, just not yet to be proven, right? So I will watch my tongue, but it's not only America. This is the globalist thing. And by saying globalist, I'm now an anti-Semite, right? It doesn't make any sense, does it? The people at this event who were speaking, there was a lot of Americans. A lot of these people work for very powerful organizations. But we also have Benjamin Netanyahu and Volodymyr Zelensky there. And a guy from the CEO of TikTok, who I think must be a Chinese national living in China. I'm not sure. But yeah, my point is just, it's not America. It's not America. It's that cult of globalism, which is the same thing as the Sustainable Development Goals, which is the same thing as the Tikkun Olam, which is basically where the predatory leaders of Judaism and the people in control of all the information have taken the Jewish people. They have taken that group that they created and they have moved them solidly away from identifying with their religion and their traditions into identifying with the goals of the predators. And they call it social justice. But that's just another lie. And the progressive Jewish people are at the forefront of that movement. And you've got to admit it. They brag about it all the time. That video I showed you earlier, the tiny clip of that woman. It's true. So to wrap up, I mean, thanks for sticking with me. It's so many interesting things I want to talk about with this, but I can't go on forever. I might have already driven you crazy by how much I talked, but this is a huge topic. And the crack where we can get some light in might be there right now. We have to use this cultural moment to reach out across this barrier, this imaginary barrier between Jews and non-Jews, and help them heal. I really, really want to help them stop being so triggered. I want them to realize that this is it's an industry, like Norman Finkelstein said. They're preying on you. They are taking your children, who should by now have long left that horrifying trauma of the Holocaust behind them. We should let everybody grow up and heal at this point. Because they're being used as pawns now. The fear is used to control people. And I believe that the Holocaust model, this trauma model, reminding people of this, traumatizing them, making them suggestible, and then steering them, planting triggers in them that you can pop up at any time. That model of controlling a people has been exported. I mean, look at BLM. They do the same thing. All the social justice stuff does. Feminism does it. COVID does it. I could go on, but why? Fill in the blank. You probably thought of examples while I was talking. So yes, please, let's heal this. This is the wrap-up slide, but I'm not going to go over it. I'll leave it there as a good graphic, as a reference of all that we've covered today. Above all, what I want is for everybody of any group to familiarize yourself with this method of control. It would be great if people could free themselves from it by being more savvy, by refusing to let them trigger you, and by recognizing that we've got to break up some of this control, some of the media ownership. In my opinion, healing the us versus them is the most productive thing we could do. At the heart of it, I really believe that every non-powerful person in the world None of the oligarchs fit into what I'm about to say. None of the monarchs, none of the captains of industry, but all of the regular people in the world. We all just want to be left alone, to pursue the career and work that we want, to eat nice meals, hear good music, laugh, dance, sing, fall in love, reproduce, raise our children, and feel secure. You know, at the end of the day, after having worked, the belly full, none of us are thinking about the other groups in the world. We don't wish harm on anybody. That's the vast, vast majority of us. So yeah, if we can get wise to the divisive tactics, then more is the better. And Jewish people, I hope you didn't get too triggered. I hope you're not thinking I'm some kind of secret anti-Semite. You're going over, aren't you? You're going over the graphics looking for where I snuck something in that can be interpreted in a wacky way. Like this person. Check this out. This is the last thing I want to show you. Because this to me, I mean, I laugh at it, but it's not funny. This to me demonstrates how far this hunt for anti-Semitic remarks has gone. This is from Twitter. Elon Musk tweeted, "Vindman is both puppet and puppeteer. Question is, who pulls his strings?" And then Adam Kinzinger says, "You mean like the Jews or something? Is that what this is?" And this person replies, "Yup, classic anti-Semitism." Is it? I mean, that's a new one on me. That's a new one on me. Puppet and puppeteer is an anti-Semitic trope now. It's classic. I don't know how I escaped all these years never hearing that one, but I guess if you are entranced, entrained, traumatized, and triggered, then anything can be anti-Semitism these days. All right, everybody. That's it. I'm going to stop talking now. Thank you for being here. Go to AmazingPolly.net. That's my website. You can find a lot of stories from around the web. You can find a way to contact me or send me financial support. That would be so much appreciated. You can donate online. There's a form there. Or my P.O. box is there to send me something through the mail. I love tinfoil. Remember, cash is king. Because so far, still, that makes us free. All right, everybody. That's it. I'm not going to keep talking. Until next time, peace out.